This is episode number 44 of the Big Web Show. This is a show, really, it's everything web that matters. We talk about things like design, content strategy, running your business on the web, all kinds of things like that. There's no limit, because the show is hosted by Jeffrey Zeldman, the godfather of the web, and by Dan Benjamin. That's me. Jeffrey, how are you doing today?
Godfather of the web.
It's good. I'm going with it. I feel okay. It. Every time I say it, I feel it.
Avenging disco godfather of the web.
We'd like to preemptively thank FreshBooks.com and MailChimp.com for sponsoring. We'll tell you more about them once we get started, but we have to introduce our guest. Another amazing guest.
We have an amazing guest who has actually been waiting for me for half an hour because of a schedule mix-up. So thank you, Sarah, for your patience as well as everything else. And Sarah Parmenter, also known as Sazzy on Twitter, is the owner of a small design studio called You Know Who, which is headquartered in Leigh-on-Sea in the UK. That's somewhere in the UK. Probably on the sea, but I don't really know.
Yeah.
And specializes in user interface design of websites, iPhone, and iPad applications. I know there's a funny story to You Know Who, so let's hear that. Let's start with that. There must be, right?
Yeah.
You call your company You Know Who. What's that about?
It's probably not so funny. It was just a curious thing that happened. It was about 1998, 1999, when I didn't actually have my own credit card or anything like that. And I saw at the bottom of the website, it said designed by You Know Who. So I clicked on it, and it actually went through someone else's website. It was very, very British, actually, very like smithandjonescompany.com or something like that. And I kept thinking, well, why have they put You Know Who at the bottom of the website and they're not called You Know Who? And excuse me, it was obviously because they wanted people who were curious to click through. So I was a bit savvy, I suppose, and thought, well, I'll call my company that, because if other people have clicked on the name You Know Who, then other people would. So I bought the domain name, but I was a bit stupid at the same time and bought the domain name with a U instead of spelt correctly, which I could have got at that time. And now they want about $10,000 for the domain name that's spelt correctly. So I wasn't that smart back then. But
unless
it
that's
like
really you.
Idea.
If you register through GoDaddy.
Yeah.
You might be the one who owns youknowwho.com, and you just don't know it because they've got, for that extra dollar, I guess it's half a pound in England, they'll give you a private. You think they're protecting your privacy, but actually what they do is obscure from you the fact that you're the owner.
No, they're definitely not doing that.
It's not you. So you're not charging yourself $10,000.
No, unfortunately. I wish I'd done that, but.
Have the original You Know Who, whoever they were, come after you? Or did they?
No.
That was just a one-off. It was just
no.
a one-off. They did it once.
They just, they just did it as a one-off thing at the bottom of their website that I happened to see. So there was no one else called You Know Who at that time. So I registered it. And
that's strategic thinking. Has it worked for you? Has anyone ever said they found you because they saw your name on the bottom of a website and it was so funny or cute or yes?
Yeah. I have. I've had phone calls, get phone calls every day of people who think it's funny to say, when you pick up the phone, you say, good morning, You Know Who. And then they think it's funny to sort of like say, no, I don't. But yeah, no, it's just a quirky name.
Yeah. So that must happen a lot.
Yeah, a lot. After 8 years, it kind of, it wears thin a little bit, but it's still good.
You need to
hire
someone fresh to answer the phone, so it'll be new to them.
I don't actually publish my telephone number anymore.
Okay, what's that about? I do the same thing, but I wonder if you do it for the same reason.
Well, because
I'll just interject and say Jeffrey does it because he can't handle all the calls from all the ladies who keep calling him late at night.
It's really not that, but thank you for the thought.
That's not what I heard.
Listeners, don't be deceived. As credible as that was, that's not really the case.
Okay.
I don't have the phone number anymore because it got to a point where sometimes I'd get people from like Twitter call and they'd be like, hi, I follow you on Twitter. And I'd be like, Hi.
Thanks for creep stalking me, and please stop calling.
And the trouble is because I'm British and we're a bit over polite, I guess sometimes. I'd sometimes find myself on the phone to these people for like 45 minutes.
Really?
Honestly. I think it happened like 3 or 4 times in the end, which is where I was kind of making small talk with people that I didn't know. And I felt really rude to kind of go, well, I'm quite busy and need to get on, because I felt like I owed them something. So
you don't have to be British to have that. I've had that. I'm just coming out of that. I've met a lot of people, and it's mostly been good. I've met a lot of people through the internet, but I've also, someone calls and you don't really, it's 20 minutes before you even say, so are you calling about business, or, and it's someone you don't know. It is weird.
Yeah.
It is weird. It's because we're on the internet, and there's this feeling of community, and the boundaries are being redrawn, but they haven't been drawn yet, really.
I'm totally in love with the community that we have around us. They are amazing, and they've helped me out of so many holes in the past. Literally, I was at a workshop last week in Ireland, tweeted saying, my MacBook won't connect to the projector screen. What do I do? I'm literally about to have people come into my classroom. And I had 20 replies from people, and all the suggestions got me out of a massive hole. So in that respect, you know, I'm completely respectful of followers that I do have, and the community that we're in is wonderful, but sometimes there are creepy people about.
And that's the thing, how do you separate that? I mean, especially, you know, being the fact that really you kind of have to put yourself out there, and maybe that's a good topic too. You have to put yourself out there as a designer, as a public speaker, somebody who speaks at conferences and things like that. You want to be accessible. You want to be involved in the community. You want to have a presence on Twitter and a personal brand. But at what point do you have to curtail that? How do you decide where those limits are, and how far out there you want to be while still having that connection? Because people know you, I think, a lot because of the sassy Twitter account, and because you do that. You put yourself out there. I mean, how do you know how to keep that in check, in balance?
I think I'm probably better at it than most people because of certain elements of my husband's job. So I have to be quite private about certain things. And there's certain things that I do keep to myself. And there's been odd times when I've kind of lost that boundary somewhere along the line, and I've tweeted something that would seem out of character for me or seem a bit too personal. And people either love you for it, or they have really strong opinions about it, which actually end up upsetting you. So I've kind of learned that there's certain things great for Twitter and fine for sharing, and there's other things that you just have to draw a line under and say, no, that's you know, that's private, and keep that to yourself.
That is hard now. I mean, I find that hard. I kind of share everything. I used to, when I started doing web content, I sort of hid behind a wall of, you know, the royal we, or third person, you know, we're presenting this, or, you know, because I thought it would look small time to sound like you were just a person or just a couple people.
And
gradually I learned that it was okay to just, you know, to not do that. And to be, I was really influenced by my friend Derek Pawazik, who was very, you know, really, and Heather Champ, people who are very personal on the web early on. And now I probably err too much in that direction. And, you kind of know when, like, you share something about something going on in your family and you get strong opinions that you really don't like.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you're like, and they start to get mad at the people, and you're like, wait a minute, I shared that, so I opened the door to that. I can't get upset with those people.
Precisely. Yeah. And I think we all have that moment where we learn that we perhaps shared a little bit too much, but then it's our fault for sharing it.
So, I mean, can you go back then, Sarah, and delete the tweet and pretend like it never happened, or, edit the blog post with the information in it? Do you do that, or do you just wait for it to blow over?
I'm not really one for doing that. I think if you put it out there in the first place, you deal with the consequences of it, really. I'm not really one for deleting stuff unless I've really made a bad slip up somewhere or a massive error of judgment. But no, I just leave it there. And I think it was Jonathan Snook. I think I tweeted something just ages ago when my grandfather passed away, and I tweeted something about going to see a psychic. And if you ever want to start a Twitter war,
oh my God,
talk about a psychic. Because you get the people who are like, yeah, good on you, and are all hippie-like. And then you get the other people who are like, oh my goodness, you really believe all that rubbish. And then you feel upset. And then you're like Jeffrey said, and then you think, well, I can't be upset because I've shared this and people are entitled to their opinions. But yeah, good one to start Twitter war, psychics.
How much, in terms of putting yourself out there, I mean, because so you're not in London or any big internet city. You're in Leoncy, I imagine, is a fairly small town.
Yeah.
Very small city.
It's 40 minutes from London. So we're just, everyone from around here basically commutes into London, but we're right on the coast. Okay. So we're just sort of on the outside of it, but near enough to sort of, for people to work there.
So you do speak publicly and you do travel, but the main way I would say that you put yourself out there, to go back to dance, you know, because if you've got a small company called You Know Who, mm-hmm, in a small town, but you do have some big clients, to get more big clients and to get more attention, you use Twitter and you use the blog. How much of that is business development, or how much business development do you do simply by being yourself on Twitter and on your blog?
Quite a lot, really. I think it's done me quite well, to be honest. But I think more so was being an early adopter of Twitter and breaking down any perceived barriers with other people who were on Twitter who were quite well known at the time. I got chatting to a lot of people and didn't really know who anyone was in the business, so to speak, in inverted commas. And I think it was having those relationships with people who were already on their way up that helped me, actually, to be honest.
Like Jeremy Keith, people like that.
Yeah, I think it was at the start, it was Ryan Carson, Elliot J. Stock, Simon Collison, Andy Clark, all those people that stupidly or being blonde, as Andy always calls me, I didn't realise sort of who those people were, if that makes sense.
Sure.
I didn't realise who they were, so I just got talking to them. And having spoken to them without any barriers or any pretenses or any kind of being terribly fanny, if you know what I mean. Not fanny. Mm. You know.
You can't say that in England.
You can't.
I know.
It means completely different thing. Anyway, being particularly like all celeb-like with them, I think helped because I was just talking to them like I would talk to a friend, and I think that was what helped right at the start.
That's a really good point that I've seen in other spheres of life. I belong to a particular club, let's say, where sometimes a celebrity will come in, and the people who just talk to them like they're just talking to anybody can have relationships with them, and people who act all starstruck can't. So,
starstruck, that's the word I was looking for. Yeah, I think that's a really important thing in any walk of life, really. I think you always have to remember that everyone's normal. You can talk to anyone and break those barriers down. I've never been particularly a starstruck person in general. I kind of have always thought, oh, they're just normal people doing a different job to my job. It's just that they're a bit more well-known than I am. And I think that genuinely helps because I think the minute you have that barrier with someone that you've put them on a pedestal, you can't talk to them on the same level anymore.
Yeah. Whereas I used to do that. And I remember meeting John Lurie and just like making a fool of myself because I was such a big fan of his music and his acting and some of the Jarmusch movies that he'd made. And I just, you know, my brother was playing music with him, which is pretty cool. And he came over and he was just a guy who'd hired my brother, you know. And I could talk to my brother. I wasn't starstruck by my brother, but for some reason, because he, you know. But now I do try. I think that's good advice for anyone in this field. If you go up and talk to someone, and I mean, it's in our field, it's kind of silly that anyone's considered a celebrity anyway, because nobody really is. We all are just artistic people
struggling
to.
Yourself.
Oh. except for Dan Benjamin.
No, here's a serious question, though. People, I remember when, like, when I met you, Jeffrey, and I've talked about this many times on the show, the first email that you sent me, I was like, I can't believe... Jeffrey Zeldman sent me an email, and it was really nice, and it was really personal and encouraging and inspiring, and it was like I still remember, Jeffrey, I doubt you remember this, but this was a life affirming time for me. Okay, I'd worked for a startup company that had imploded, laid everybody off. I was trying to figure out what to do. I was trying to find a job. I was doing all this other stuff. And I emailed you about something. And you said something like this. Employer, you don't need an employer. They need you. You know, you're the talented person. You're the person that they should be begging to come work for them. And this wasn't so much me. This was you as the collective you of creative people. But you were directing to me. I remember that. And I was like, man. And like that inspired me for months and months and months on end to eventually, you know, like go full time and do my own, you know, do my own thing and all of that. So, you know,
look at you.
And so I credit you for the success in no small part, that's the kind of thing why I think people do in a way put you on a pedestal in a way. And you too, Sarah, I mean, you guys are both, you're very much out there in the design community. You're very much talking about this kind of thing and people respect that. And it's that respect that, yeah, they kind of do get starstruck in a way. They kind of do think, you know, this is a big deal, right? This is something that, I can't just walk up to that guy and that girl up there. I can't do that. These are big people. I can't just walk up to them.
Yeah, I had someone be like that at an event apart, actually, and it was so sweet. It was probably the first time that it properly happened, and she was so lovely, and I felt like I had to sort of say to her, don't be silly, it's just me, I'm no one special, you know, let's grab a drink and have a chat. But she was, I mean, everyone at an event apart was lovely anyway. All of the people who attend are amazing and very, very smart. But that happened, yeah, for the first time at an event apart.
So I think you're going to have to start getting used to that kind of thing, because I think, especially, you know, as you're out there, as you're speaking at an event apart now, I mean, that's prestigious, right? I mean, so how do you balance this out with the actual work that you're trying to do? And again, you often hear me asking questions about balance. But I'm very interested to hear your answer. I mean, you work from home, but you travel a lot. You're doing the workshops now. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, as far as balancing everything, I pretty much took the whole of March off. I've learned that I do 2 months, book 2 months work of worth of work solid, and then I give myself a buffer month to get any conference stuff finished up, or to get any projects that have overrun finished and sorted out in a timely manner. And I've kind of learned that I need a buffer month in between 2 months of solid work, because what we do is we're very lucky. It's very well paid in comparison to other people's jobs who do work just as hard. So I'm very blessed that I can do that. I take 2 months work and then take a buffer month and then book 2 months work. And so during that buffer month, I'm able to write proposals and get everything out and not have it rushed in between other jobs. So I've kind of learned my little secret niche this year is to do 2 months work, buffer month, 2 months work, a buffer month.
Let me ask you a question.
Sure.
Does the, like when, okay, I'll back up. Malarkey, a friend of yours, right? Andy Clark, friend of mine,
yeah.
Friend of the show. When he speaks, part of what enthralls American audiences is that he has this lovely accent, very different from yours. Actually,
yes.
probably not considered a lovely accent in England, but, and you have a very different lovely accent, and like, for Americans, it's like I could drool over this stuff. It's enthralling. But what I want to know is, does that same thing happen in England? Do you guys like listen to each other and go, "Oh my God, I love your English accent so much," or you don't because it's?
Yes, we have very our accents in England. That you go 40 miles. Well, my dad is from Ilford, which is in Essex. I'm in Leigh on Sea, which is in Essex. My dad was born in Ilford, which is about 20 miles north of here. my dad's got a completely different accent. When our American friends come over, they can tell the different. They can tell the difference between my accent and my dad's accent. That's how many different accents we have in England. So there are certain accents which I don't like in England, and I won't say them for fear of offending anyone. And there's other accents that are really easy on the ear. Liverpudlian accents are really nice to listen to. Scottish accents are obviously lovely. Irish is very easy on the ear as well. But we have such a broad range of accents in this country. Andy's accent is more northern. Mine's more southern.
Yeah. They're great. They're really lovely. So maybe that explains all this.
Oh, you use lovely.
Yeah. What does that mean in England? Does that mean something?
We're going to have to explain this.
We have, okay, you want to explain this? Yeah, because...
Actually, we can't. It's a family show.
Yeah, but well, apparently there are certain words that are perfectly innocent in America that have a naughty meaning in England. And
This is an American show, so we can say the American words. And
It's an international show, but...
producing it in America, guys.
That's true. So what do you remember, like, the first word? Can you say it? I don't remember what the first word was that...
I remember you calling someone a bender in the bar, and I went, whoa, whoa.
That was an English person saying that.
Was it? I thought you said something about that.
Oh, going on a bender?
Yeah, you can go on it.
It means a drunk. Like, going on a bender means going on a drunk.
Yeah, you can say that in England. I thought you said something else.
Okay. You don't remember what these words were? They were really innocent-sounding words, like... pass me a teacup or...
No, it wasn't.
Those are lovely flowers on the mantelpiece. And you said, mantelpiece?
And you, it was.
I don't remember what they were, but they were really innocent-sounding words.
I'll have to try and remember what some of them were.
Oh, and I know there was something about... Anyway, I can't because it is a family show. I remember now. I remember now, but I can't.
Don't say, I remember fully well what we were talking about. But
oh, okay.
Another time.
Another time.
So while we regroup here, I've got a question for you. Nice, you know, you're over there in the UK, and a lot of the, you know, we joked about this being an American show. It's not, but you know, you're over there in the UK, and so many of the events and things that take place, we'll pick an event apart for one of them, South by Southwest. I mean, whatever it is, so many of them, while you guys do have great conferences over
there's
the majority are here though, aren't
you
they?
Think?
Aren't they? So, well, I keep seeing Sarah getting on a plane to come over here.
That's true.
Yeah.
So can you talk about that? I mean, how does that play into the whole thing? I mean, you're based there and you've got to travel pretty much any time, even if it is a UK conference, you've still got to do quite a bit of traveling. How does that work with your work schedule? I mean, can you do that with your all within your buffer month every time?
Not every time. I mean, but having that buffer month definitely helps because generally the conferences are spread from month to month or within a 6-week period sometimes. So generally I'll work, like at Christmas, I was doing my stuff for the New Adventures conference, Simon Collison's conference. And then during February and March, I was doing my stuff for an event apart during certain days that I'd booked out of my schedule. So I think I'm just hyper-organized, to be honest, because I book everything out in iCal, and then I know exactly where I try and leave buffer days as well.
Mm.
So I'm always, I think I'm just a bit, over-organized sometimes. It's a good thing. Definitely a good thing, but with the conferencing, obviously you don't get suddenly asked to do a conference this month. You'd know sort of 2 months in advance.
Right,
right. So that will go in my diary, and then I'll know that I need a certain amount of time to do the slides to the standard that I want to do them to, and then I'll book that out in my calendar. And I'm just a bit OCD like that, I think.
Besides being the face of your company, besides representing your company by, you know, through your personality, through your blog, you obviously try to differentiate your work as well in other ways. And I was wondering, you gave a talk in Seattle about the psychology of design. I was wondering if how much of that goes into the kind of work you do on iPhone, iPad, or web design. How much psychological thinking are you doing? And if you could give some examples of that, because it was a really it was a lovely talk, and it's a really nice concept.
The psychological thing is a really new thing for me. It's something that I got interested in when I was researching what I was going to talk about in Event Apart. And I was reading a lot of books towards the end of last year to do with the psychology behind lots of things. I find decision-making particularly interesting. So it's a really new thing for me that I've started looking into. And obviously I looked into it in great depth for an Event Apart. To be honest, the only stuff that I'm really looking into at the moment in using in my own designs is the stuff that I'm comfortable and have learnt enough about, which is kind of like the social proof stuff that I talked about in my talk, which is how certain behaviours, how we look to crowd behaviour to influence our personal behaviour. So we'll look to a group of people behaving in a certain way and we'll assume that that behaviour is the right way to behave, or that they're doing something that we should be doing. Like I used an example in an Event Apart of the lines that we see outside of Apple when they have a new product launch. That would be an example of social proofing, because someone might walk past that line and think, well, if all those people are standing in line, they must be standing in line for a good reason, know about a product that I don't know about. And it all comes down to social proofing. So that's the only element that I'm truly using at the moment within my website designs and the user interface stuff, because it's the only element that I'm truly comfortable with that actually has a complete synergy with the web at the moment. I'm still learning and delving into other things.
Social briefing.
Social proofing. It's called
proofing,
social proofing. Yeah,
right.
Social proof.
So it's kind of like the first website I worked on was for Warner Brothers, and we had discussion forums, but of course nobody had used the website yet. And we did what they used to call seeding, where we wrote the first couple of forum posts ourselves.
Yeah.
Right? And publications still do this all the time. But the reason is, and it's the thing you're talking about, social proof. If I come to a website that has a discussion, and still, we still do this today when we create social networks for clients, we populate them initially, not to cheat or trick anybody, but because if someone goes to the website and it looks dead, they're not going to want to use it.
That's exactly, right? Yeah, that's
and
exactly
used,
it.
One of the reasons, everyone complains about Facebook, but one of the reasons Facebook has traction is because Facebook has traction.
Yeah.
Everybody's there because everybody's there. And when you go to a different network, when people say, oh, I don't like this or that policy of Facebook, so let's all start using Phenomenon blog, Phenomenon or whatever. But you go there and your friends aren't there and you start to feel discouraged and you end up going back to Facebook and going, well, I guess it's really not so bad, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, that's precisely it. Social proofing is something that I'm using on websites at the moment, and trying to simplify things as well is something I spoke about at AA. We're going through a phase now of simplifying websites, which is great.
What does that mean?
We're going backwards from what you were saying earlier about how we used to write our copy years ago, and we used to try and big ourselves up. I don't know if that's a term
right.
You guys have, where we
right.
kind of say, oh, we have these offices and everything's in third person and spoken about as though you're a much bigger company than you actually are. We're actually seeing a reverse of that happening now, where people are okay with saying, hey, it's just me, I'm working here, I will work hard for you and we'll get the result that you're looking for. We're simplifying all of our interactions on the web now, which is brilliant. You're seeing a lot of websites go with really simple sales messages as well. Like I know 37 Signals have built their whole business up on being simple, and they've never really kowtowed to people saying that they wanted new features in Basecamp or anything like that. And we're seeing more companies do that. We're realizing that we've got shorter and shorter attention spans, and we're all designing accordingly to that as well. So that's something that I'm trying to do a lot of at the moment, especially with iPhone and iPad development.
Well, and you've been doing these. Sorry, Jeffrey, I want to get to this. We need to talk about your workshops, your iOS workshops, because that's a big part now of what you're focusing on, what you're doing. And there's people in the chat room asking questions. When are they coming to New York City and things like that? But to keep everybody in suspense, we also need to thank our sponsor. So let's do that. And then we can
yes.
hear your answer. Our first sponsor is FreshBooks.com. And I switched to these guys for all the invoicing that I'm doing. And man, it's so much better. It's so much better. I used to use QuickBooks. My accountant said, Dan, just use QuickBooks, and this is what we want you to use. I finally had the strength and courage to stand up to him and say no more. I put my foot down. I said, that's it. I'm done with this. And it is like a whole new world now. Everything is organized. Everything is simple. And this is the thing. You can go to FreshBooks.com. You sign up for a free account. When you're doing that, it'll ask where you heard about it. Put in Big Web Show. Because every week, they're going to give away a free cake. This is real. They're going to be giving away a free cake to a Big Web Show listener every week. So go there. If it's a free account, sign up. But here's it. Don't just fill it out to get the cake. Actually try it. Most of the people that listen to this show are doing freelance work. They're doing consulting. They're doing projects. Try using this thing for invoicing, because you can do a few clients for free. I promise you will like it as much as I do. It will simplify everything. I actually enjoy doing this. So do it. Sign up. Get a free cake. Go to FreshBooks.com. And thanks very much to them for checking it out. I really think you're going to like this. I'm really glad to get these guys as a sponsor. So, Sarah, talk to us about this. You decided to do these iOS workshops.
Yes.
And this is a big thing. And you went out. I mean, people don't understand when you decide, Jeffrey can talk about this, but when you decide to do a conference, especially even a small one, a seminar, a workshop like this, you're really sticking your neck out there. You're really going out on a limb for this financially, reputation. I mean, you name it, right?
Yeah, I mean, it costs quite a lot to put them on, to be honest, especially in England where everything is ridiculously expensive anyway. You have to shell out for the venue, the catering, and then you always have to give little goodies away as well, like little bits and pieces to give to your attendees and stuff like that. So yeah, it is a huge financial responsibility to suddenly decide to do one. But I'd wanted to do one for ages. I really enjoy teaching. So I decided at the beginning of the year, it was one of my New Year resolutions to do a workshop. And thankfully, I'm very blessed that it sold out last month. Well, we had one ticket come back, which sold yesterday. So we sold out really quickly. But it was one of those things that I really didn't know how it was going to go. It would either be that people would be really interested, or I could have ended up with 5 people or 10 people, but I'm trying to keep them really small to 25 people. And thankfully, they seem to have been really successful so far. I've already done one in Ireland just before I flew to an event apart, actually. I did one in Ireland, and I've got one in London in 2 weeks' time.
If I were to attend one of these workshops, what would I learn about iOS in a sentence or two?
Basically, I'm taking everyone through iOS design right from the beginning to we're actually going to design sample apps. I've come up with 5 sample apps for people to design, and then we all learn from each other's apps at the end of the day. So it's basically how to design for iOS devices, iPhone and iPad, and Retina display. It's not going into any of the development side of things.
That's really cool. What's the connection between being good, loving teaching, and being good at client services? Because I think there is one.
I don't know. I came from a sort of teaching / acting background, so I don't know if that has something to do with it. My first job right out of school was doing teaching for, we have these things called theatre and education companies over here. And they employ actors to teach children about sex education, drug education, smoking, you name it. And I used to do that. I did that for 3 years. And I always enjoyed it. I always enjoyed the teaching element of it. So it was something that I definitely wanted to get back into doing.
You were also, you played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, right?
I did. I had a great moustache.
Is there a connection between client services and acting?
I think there's a good communication level. I think you might possibly be better at communicating than some other people, because web designers kind of have this persona that you sit in a room and when you ring them, they grunt at you and you don't get a lot out of them. But I think actually that's not the case anymore. I think we've moved on from that. But I think from a communication point of view, I think certainly from a speaking point of view, it's helped me for the conferences and things, because I look at them as kind of like when you get up on stage and do a show, but not in that kind of way, because you haven't got a character to hide behind. It's just you. If people don't like you, it's not because you're playing Tevye, it's because they don't like Sarah Parmenter, which can be quite harsh.
You're getting back to that same thing you were talking about earlier, too, about simplifying websites, being honest about being small, like saying, you know, this is really me. When you hire me, you're hiring me, not when you hire me, then I have a junior art director come in and do my job.
Yeah, no, I've never been one for that.
It's weird because I think there was a time when it was a much more attractive proposition to a business before the crash, before the dot-com crash in the late 90s. You really wanted to throw as much money as you could at something. You're like, oh, I know we need a website and I've got to spend at least $1 million, otherwise it'll suck. And I've got to work with a really big design firm that has a huge name and offices everywhere. And now I think that has all changed and people are more likely to say, I'd like to work with someone where I know who's on the team and I like them and they get me and all that. So I think today, because of this change, which is reflected in the way we design websites, as you said, but it means that you can be from Brixton on Thames. It means you could be from anywhere. And if you put yourself out there, if you teach, if you speak, if you have some good things to say, if you're part of the community, you can compete and you can do good work and have good client relationships.
Yeah, I think it's all about being willing to take that extra step of if you put yourself out there, you have to know that there's a possibility that the majority of people aren't going to like you. They might not like the way you look. They might not like the way you talk. And as long as you're ready for anything that comes back at you, if you're putting yourself out there, then it kind of goes back to what we were saying about Twitter. You can't blame people for having an opinion. If you're putting yourself out there, you have to take the good with the bad. I've not been particularly great, I must admit, at doing that because I'm a hugely sensitive female. And I'll be the first to admit that there's been times when I haven't dealt with things in a proper manner and I've not dealt with them as I would have liked to have done if I'd have taken a step back from things for a day. But I think it all comes as part and parcel of what we do. If you're going to put yourself out there and get the better clients because they can see that you're reputable and that you've got an online presence and blah, 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 then you have to deal with the odd idiot who pops up and wants to say nasty things about you.
Have you had anyone... we've had other people on the show who've had people trash, you know, who've been trash talked inappropriately. And is there anything like that you wanted to talk about? Or
yeah, I don't mind talking about it. It happened on a popular podcast type situation like this, actually, where we all had slots during the day. I think there was about 8 or 9 of us, and we all had slots during the day for about half an hour each, and it was a marathon podcast type thing. And I was sandwiched between Relly Annett Baker and Andy Clark, which was nice, almost like following Jeffrey Zeldman at an event apart, you know, not scary at all, which is what happened. Yeah, I started talking and I made the mistake of having the chat room open on the right-hand side. And the minute I started talking, it was like what I was saying wasn't getting heard, but people were looking at me and stereotyping me into a very bad kind of niche of saying, well, she's only doing this because she's blonde and she's got a British accent and she looks like this or looks like that. And that really upset me, actually. It was one of the definite low points in my career because even though I come from a family where I was an only child, and the biggest thing that people then say if you're an only child is that you're spoiled, I had to earn everything. I never got anything handed to me on a plate. My mum and dad just weren't like that. And to have people saying that I only was where I was, their words, not mine, because of perhaps the way I look or the way I speak or anything, any other reason other than that I'd worked hard was what really got to me.
Go ahead.
I went offline for a good week and a half, I think, after that happened, and learned who my true friends were on Twitter, and had lots of nice messages from people. Not that you do it for that, not that you do it to have people saying, oh, you poor thing. It's not about that. But it was nice to have, you know, people like Andy Clark, Simon Collison ringing you up and actually sort of checking you're all right, going that step further than it just being a relationship on Twitter. Actually having a feeling of, is that person okay? And that obviously what happened to them wasn't okay for it to happen. And there was a bit of a community shift after that, thankfully, I think for the right reasons. And it happened about 18 months, 2 years ago. It was quite a while ago. And I think, yeah, that was definitely a low point, but it hasn't happened too much since.
I'd love to think that people in our community are smarter and better than in other communities, but sexism is everywhere. And women, a lot of times, if women start to gain prominence or start to be accepted for their work or whatever, there's all kinds of that gets unleashed on them that men don't have to deal with. That, you know, men have other stuff. Everybody has stuff. But there's always like, well, how did you really get the job or what? You know, there's always that stuff. So,
yes. Sucks. Yeah, it wasn't cool, but, you know, like I said, you have to take the rough with the smooth, and it happened, and actually, thankfully, it had a tiny impact on the community as a whole. It kind of got known that that wasn't acceptable on a more broader spectrum of people, and newer people coming into the community as well could see that there was quite a few blog posts written about it, actually, and there was someone who did like a video saying that this isn't acceptable and this should be stamped out in our community. And I think, in a way, it was for the greater good, but it was a shame that it had to fall on my shoulders, in a way.
So since then, have things changed? Has it gotten better? You mentioned that it's not quite the same way. I mean, do you think that there are... Because every time you've been on one of these shows, a lot of people on Twitter, especially the female listeners, the women in the audience, will talk about how inspiring you are for them. And we talked about this a little on the Pipeline episode that you were on. But I think you really are a role model. You're a representation for a lot of women, and not just design women, but women, professional women everywhere. Do you feel that is a burden? Do you feel a responsibility there?
I do, actually. And just the week before an event apart, I did a inspirational women conference for a whole theatre full of girls who were 16, 17 years old, just leaving school and looking to make decisions about what they're going to do with their lives. And I was up against some other amazing people. And I had a moment where I was standing on stage telling my story of how I am where I am today, sort of thing. And I had a moment of, I really don't feel like I'm worthy of standing up here, to be honest. I've worked really, really hard. I've worked my bum off, yes, but probably no more than the average nurse or someone like that. It just, sometimes it baffles me, but I do feel a sense of responsibility, especially as at that conference, actually, a girl came up to me and she was being bullied. And she was saying how much she loved Twitter, because I mentioned Twitter in my talk to the girls, and I said that it was a really good bearing on my life. And she mentioned that she was being bullied and that her friends weren't really, she didn't really have any friends. It was all Twitter friends. And afterwards, I walked up to her after the talk, and I spoke to her face to face in front of the other girls, and I just said to her, look, don't let anyone get you down. You know, this is a temporary thing, and girls at this age are really not very nice people. And the teacher then emailed me and said that I had no idea how much effect that had on that girl, and that she was like a different person the next day. So in that sense, I do feel a sense of responsibility, especially with younger people coming into the industry. But I feel privileged that I'm in a position that I can do that, to be honest.
That's great. Will you talk to my daughter too?
Oh, I would so want to meet your daughter.
Okay.
Oh, she's so lovely.
But she has that. I mean, stuff to deal with at school, social stuff. It starts really early.
It does start too early. It's nasty. School children can be so nasty.
It's weird. Yeah, and you think it won't happen to your kid. You think, well, that happened to me, but those times were different, but those, you know, they just have different ways of doing the same stuff. It's really, it's probably just primate stuff.
But it's so relative at that age as well. I mean, something that we might think, you know, oh, well, that's nothing, darling. Don't worry about it. We can say don't worry about it until we're blue in the face. But actually, it's relative to them. If someone's stolen their pencil and they keep stealing their pencil, we might think it's ridiculous. But to them, it's relative. And I think that's right. What a lot of adults don't realize.
Yeah, no, kids are very sensitive and they really hurt. And you know, it could be the wrong flavor of cupcake, but it's still a real thing to them. You know,
yes.
Right. Thing, and you have to respect that, you know, so that's good doing that. That's good.
Now, listen, we've got a bunch of questions coming in from the listeners who are in the chat room. I just want to mention, people are always asking me how they do that. How do you see the show, participate in the show? You go to 5by5.tv/live/audio if you don't want to have the flash video at all. And there's a little chat button. You click it and you can participate in this. You can ask questions. So we've got a bunch of them for Sarah that we'd like to get to. But before we do that, we want to thank MailChimp. They have a really cool new product they came out with. It's called Chimp Kit. And we're going to be talking about a lot of these questions are about iOS for you, Sarah. But one of the big problems, I think, for developers, for people who are creating iOS apps is staying in touch with their users, getting to be able to communicate with them, because Apple controls all that. You don't know who's buying your app. You know how many you've sold, but you can't get in touch with them. Well, MailChimp is working to help that. They came out with something. I love this name. It's called Chimp Kit. And Chimp Kit is a drop-in component that you can integrate into your app seamlessly. You can also stylize and customize and make it work differently, but it has everything you need. It's open source. You drop it into your app and allows users to sign up directly with your MailChimp newsletter, so that you can have a custom special newsletter that you send just to those people who want to become involved. It gives you a whole new channel to communicate with them. And of course, it's free for up to 2,000 subscribers. All of this is free and it's open source. So go to MailChimp.com/ChimpKit to find out about that. So
I still don't know how they do that. How do they do that free stuff?
I don't know how they do that. I don't know how they do that.
It's
amazing. So let me ask you a couple of these questions that are coming in. Thanks again to MailChimp. Love them. God, I love them. It's crazy how much I love them.
They are great.
Do you prefer to design or develop these days? And people are saying, this is Blaine Smith. They're saying, I find it difficult to define my job. How do you define what it is that you're doing? Where what space do you fit in?
I've suddenly made peace with the fact, and I think it's probably in the last month actually, I've made peace with the fact I am a designer. I can code. I can code my designs, but I'm a designer. Predominantly, because I don't think what I do, I do front end development. I do HTML, CSS, a little bit of JavaScript, a little bit of jQuery, enough to get by and get the functionality I want. But really, I'm a designer.
Does making that distinction, is that helpful? Is that help in framing the kind of work that you do or your approach?
Yeah, it definitely has, because before, when I used to get inquiries that used to say, oh, you know, I need development of this, that and the other, I suddenly realized that it was okay to send back a message saying, okay, that's fine, but that's not really my area of expertise, and realize that another inquiry will come along that realizes that I'm a better designer than I am developer, and use me for that talent, so to speak, rather than the development side. So I've realized that it's okay to be really niche, or what do you guys say, niche or something?
I like the way you say it a little bit better.
Yeah. It's okay to really clarify what you do, and I've made peace with that recently. It's a very recent thing, actually. I've thought I would have to still say, oh, you know, I still front end code my designs and things, which I do, and I'll happily do it. I really love doing it. It's where I came from, but I am a designer.
Well, and one of the, I guess, related questions, Aaron Baznet. I'm that terrible with names. If you haven't figured that out yet, he asks, how much iOS versus web design are you doing? When you talk about design, is iOS, is it taking over your focus? He asks, is this, when you talk about design, does that include designing the interfaces on iOS, or do you feel that that's a separate thing entirely?
Yeah, it is a separate thing. I'm doing about 50-50 at the moment. I'm doing sort of 50% web UI and then about 50% iPhone, iPad UI. I specialise in the iPhone and iPad UI because not many people do, and I think quite a few people don't realise that it's not just a case of opening up Photoshop and changing the size of your canvas. So it's pretty much still split down the middle. I still love doing web interfaces, and I equally love doing the iPhone stuff, but the iPhone stuff is kind of where I've chosen to sort of specialise rather than taking on BlackBerry, Windows, mobile, blah, 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 blah. I've just decided to go with iOS and that's it. I've drawn a line under it because it's enough to constantly learn with iOS without diluting it down to BlackBerries and everything else. So, Yeah, I think I've just realized that it's okay to specialize.
So does everyone, and by Derek J asks, does everyone need to be thinking about or developing for mobile? Can you be a designer in 2011 without being that, being a multi-faceted designer?
Oh, I think it's the same with everything. I think having a knowledge of these things is always a requirement if you're taking on work of any sort, having just general knowledge. But no, I think, you know, the web's not going to die tomorrow. There's still plenty of work to go around with just the web space, so...
But mobile is different from iOS too. I mean, mobile is its own thing. You do have to have some awareness of mobile and some thinking about it, or you're going to be in trouble, I think.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
If you're a web designer who just designs 1028 by 764 Photoshop comps and brings them to life in CSS, you're going to have problems.
Yeah, no, that's not going to work. You're obviously going to need some idea of how that then translates if someone picks up a mobile device of any sort, not just an iOS device. Okay. Yeah, but I love designing for mobile. I love designing for iPhone. So I have a broad knowledge of how to design, you know, using media queries and things like that. But I specialize in actual native apps for the iPhone, which is slightly different.
Right.
Pixelcraft asks, over the last 2 years, I don't know why 2 years, but over the last 2 years, do clients find you or do you find them? And has there been a shift at any point? And that was something I've been thinking about too, is as you've gained prominence, as you've built a name for yourself, has it gone from you having to try to find them on your own or hoping, or now you just booked up and you're saying, oh, of these five clients, I'm going to pick these two. Has it changed for you? But just over the past 2 years?
No, I've actually always been quite lucky in that, apart from right at the beginning, I mean, you know who's been going since 2003, which is quite old for someone of my age, if you know what I mean. It's quite an old company for me, who's 27 now. And at the start, I had to really, really work hard to do marketing and advertising and go to lots of networking events. But since then, I don't know if it's because I live in a small town and word got round, but I've thankfully, touch wood, never really had to go out and seek clients apart from when I was first starting up the business. I think it's that age-old thing. If you do good work, it speaks for itself sometimes. Or if you're too cheap, which I was right at the beginning.
how do you counter that? I mean, how do you counter being too cheap? And when you're starting out, you almost feel like you have to be cheap to get the jobs, right? How do you get past that? Once you've been too cheap, how do you then raise your rates and when do you know when it's okay to do that?
I think it's one of the hardest things in the world. I really do, because I've still got clients. I've still got one client who's my oldest client, who was my second ever client. And thankfully, they've grown as I've grown. So we've kind of raised our rates together. But then there's been certain clients who their business hasn't taken off as well. And I've had to have that conversation of, yeah, you know how I could build a website for £50 back in 2001? I can't do that anymore. And that's an awkward conversation because you've already set that expectation with the client. And so having that conversation with them, I think, is one of the hardest things in the world. But you have to have that conversation and explain. I think it's all down to communication. If you can communicate well and explain why you can't do these things at a certain price anymore, then and you're honest about it, then that's how I've always been. I've always been a bit too honest for my own good, actually. That's one of my mantras that I live to. But I've always been honest with my clients all the way along. If they want something that I think they don't need and I could earn £3,000 from it, I'll be the one that says, look, guys, you don't really need this. I've always been like that. And I think having that honesty right from the start, they know that you're never going to rip them off. So if you have to increase your rates, it makes it slightly easier.
Yeah, I was just sitting here and shaking my head like, yes, that's what we do too. That's what we do too. Just establish honest right up the front and say what people do and don't need, and then they will trust you.
So what is what does the future hold for you, Sarah? What are the things? I mean, obviously you've got these workshops that you're working on. Are there any new sites or anything else? Any apps that you can talk about yet, or things that we can look for that have your handiwork in them?
Yeah, I'm working on a lovely app for the NBCF, which is in America, National Breast Cancer Foundation. And I'm so thrilled to be working on that because I know that it will help so many people. I've just finished their website UI and we're now working on the iPhone and the iPad applications. And they'll be coming out, I think, fairly soon in the next 6 weeks or so. So I'm enjoying working on those at the moment, to be honest. They're taking up all my time. And a website for new mums as well.
Oh, very cool. And so these are going to be coming out. When do you know yet? Can you say
the website for the new mums is coming out in June, so that's a while away yet. But the iPhone and the iPad app for NBCF is coming out in the next 6 weeks, so probably about mid May.
Very cool, very cool. Well, I think unfortunately, I think we're out of time.
Okay.
But if people want to find out more about you, they can go to Szzy, S-E-Z-Z-Y, on Twitter. And where should they go on the web? You've got a couple different places. Where's a good starting point for them?
If they want to learn about me, then szzy.co.uk, S-A-Z-Z-Y.co.uk is where I brain fart all my thoughts.
So they can go there and they can also follow you on Twitter, as they should.
Yeah.
For ongoing entertainment from the UK. And no, we can look for these apps. We can look. I'm sure you'll tweet and talk about them when they're out, right?
Oh yeah, definitely.
Very good. Well, Jeffrey, unless you've got anything else to add, I think that about does it.
That was awesome. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate you being here. Really appreciate it. We'll definitely have you back. Thanks everybody for tuning in. Thanks to FreshBooks.com, MailChimp.com for making this possible. Go to 5x5.tv to hear all the other shows that we do there. And please consider rating the show on iTunes. I say that sometimes, but it really makes a difference. It's the main way that the shows bubble up to the top, and it helps new people find out about them. So go and rate the show if you enjoyed it. If you didn't enjoy it, don't rate it. And thanks very much. We'll see y'all again next week. Have a great week.